Hello, and welcome back to True Crime Cat Lawyer. I'm your host, Elise. Every week, I share true crime cases from my hometown of the Pacific Northwest. My goal is to create ethical true crime content and educate others about the legal/criminal justice system. Please be sure to follow us on social media at True Crime Cat Lawyer for Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok, and True Crime Cat Law on Twitter. And please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or a rating on Spotify. We also have a Patreon page, which is linked in our show notes. Or you can head to patreon.com to join for just $5 a month. All proceeds from our Patreon are donated to animal rescues and shelters. Finally, we now have an Etsy sticker shop where you can buy true crime and cat stickers. Again, all proceeds from the sticker shop are donated to animal rescues and shelters. The link to the sticker shop is in our show notes, but you can also find us by searching True Crime Cat Lawyer in Etsy. As always, this podcast contains content of a graphic nature, including physical and sexual violence, suicide, and crimes against animals and children. Listener discretion is advised. Hello, and welcome back to the show. Before we get started, I want to add an extra trigger warning for this episode. This episode centers around sexual assault and rape. Although I don't usually discuss the graphic details, it's important to me to tell these stories in their authenticity as the survivors have shared them. I want to talk about these heavy subjects in an informative and compassionate way. I also want to acknowledge that I normally wouldn't share survivors' names. However, these women whose stories I'll be sharing have publicly stated that they don't want to be anonymous, which is the only reason why I'm sharing their real names. April is National Sexual Assault Awareness Month. According to the Center for Disease Control, sexual violence affects millions of people every year in the United States. 1 in 4 women have experienced either a completed or attempted rape. Almost half of rape victims were raped as minors before they turned 18. In fact, according to RAIN, the Rape Abuse and Incest National Network, ages 12 to 34 are the highest risk years for rape and sexual assault. According to RAIN, someone in the U.S. is sexually assaulted every 68 seconds, and 90% of adult rape victims are female. Although the vast majority of rapes are committed by someone the victim knows, stranger rapes aren't uncommon. 19.5% of rapes and sexual assaults are committed by a stranger. Besides April being National Sexual Assault Awareness Month, there are a few other reasons I wanted to discuss the cases in today's episode. First, the rapes and sexual assaults covered in this episode actually took place near where I grew up in Southeast Portland several years before I was born. And second, this episode is a warning to all listeners who live in Oregon because the asshole I'm going to talk about today is out amongst you and could actually be living in your neighborhood, and the state isn't required to tell you that he lives there. On January 8, 1979, a 22-year-old woman, who we'll call Jill, was living in the 147 block of Southeast Rhine Street in Southeast Portland. She went to Mount Hood Community College for 2 years and then started working as a secretary at a local law firm. Around 8 p.m. that night, Jill was cooking dinner in her kitchen. She saw someone in the hallway, but thought it was just one of her roommates. She asked, "Who's home?" When she got no response, she went around the corner and was met by an unknown man who grabbed her around the throat. The man held Jill in a headlock and demanded money. He then punched her in the face before forcing her onto the floor. He again demanded money, and she told him that she only had $3. Jill struggled with the man who had pantyhose over his face. She saw a small hatchet in his hands and was screaming while the man was hitting and punching her. Quote, "All I could think of was my mom. If something happened to me after my brother's death, she wouldn't be able to live with that," end quote. The man punched Jill in the face 4 to 5 more times, ripped off her shirt, and, quote, "rubbed the edge of his hatchet along her neck and face," end quote. He then tore her pants off. The man couldn't perform and eventually got up and left. Jill ran out the door to her neighbor's house. She had a black eye on the left side and her nose was bleeding. Her neighbors called 911. Jill was one of 12 kids and denied being sexually assaulted when her mom asked. 5 months after the assault, Jill and her roommates got a huge dog. Jill lived in fear after the assault. Quote, "You just never have the sense you can protect yourself enough," end quote. On November 11, 1979, 17-year-old Daniel Tudor, a senior at David Douglas High School, was home alone watching The King and I in her basement den. Danielle's parents had left around 6:45 to go visit some friends, and Danielle's four older siblings weren't home either. Danielle thought she heard a noise outside the door, but didn't pay much attention to it because she thought it was the wind. But then, a man kicked in the door to the den from the garage. The man wasn't wearing anything to conceal his face, and the two stared at each other. The man turned and ran out of the room. Danielle then ran up two flights of stairs to her parents' room and called 911. The family dog followed Danielle to her parents' room and started growling while she was on the phone. Danielle told the dispatcher, quote, "The dog is starting to growl. I think he's coming back," end quote. Danielle said that she could see the intruder coming up the stairs, and he was wearing a bandana over his face and holding a long stick. The man came into the bedroom, kicked over the lamp, yanked the phone out of the wall, and demanded to know who Danielle had called. Danielle told the man that she called her brother. The man then punched Danielle in the stomach, pushed her up against the wall, and then picked her up and threw her onto her parents' bed. Danielle kicked the man while he tried to take off her pants, and she begged him not to hurt her. The two wrestled, and Danielle fell onto the floor. The man eventually pulled down her pants, took off his pants, and attempted to rape Danielle. Danielle yelled out that she'd heard someone, which distracted the man, and he backed off. The man demanded to know where Danielle's family kept their money. He put his pants on and rifled through a drawer before running off. Danielle was in shock, but she managed to grab a bathrobe and ran to her neighbor's house. As she was running, the police pulled up to her house. Danielle was taken to the hospital to be checked out. She gave the police a detailed description of her attacker. After the attack, Danielle became fearful of men and boys, and she missed a lot of school. She, quote, "went into a shell, went into lockdown mode," end quote, and couldn't be home alone. The assault robbed Danielle of her innocence/youth and shattered her sense of security. Unfortunately, Danielle's rapist wouldn't be caught for years. 16-year-old Alyssa Warner was a student at Gresham Union High School. On March 2, 1980, Alyssa was listening to music and drinking beer at a friend's house with her boyfriend. Alyssa and her boyfriend got into an argument and he stormed off. Alyssa followed him to try and make up. She walked to his house and banged on his bedroom window, but he didn't answer. Alyssa wasn't sure if she should walk home or go back to her friend's house. She decided to sit down in her boyfriend's front yard with her back to the street. She'd been sitting there for about 45 minutes when a man came and put his hand over her mouth. As Alyssa turned around, the man punched her in the left eye. He said, quote, "scream and I'll kill you," end quote. Alyssa tried to stand up, but the man pushed her down as a car drove past. The man had a hand over Alyssa's mouth and both of her hands behind her back. The man lifted Alyssa's shirt up to cover her face and then dragged her to the backyard. Alyssa tried to play along, but that didn't work. She was yelling for help, but no one heard her, despite the fact that she was just outside her boyfriend's house. The man stripped off Alyssa's clothes except her shirt and then raped her. He threatened to stab her if she fought him. After it was over, the man got up. Alyssa tried to get up too, but the man hit her in the face and kicked her in the stomach. He even threatened to cut off one of Alyssa's breasts as a souvenir. He told Alyssa to count to 10 and then ran off. Alyssa just sat there crying. The man had taken her coat, her clothes, her keys, and a garage door opener. Alyssa covered herself with her shirt and pounded again on her boyfriend's window. Eventually, Alyssa's boyfriend's mom woke up, took her inside, and gave her a blanket and some clothes. Alyssa's boyfriend's mom wanted to call the police, but Alyssa said no. She was scared because she had been out past her curfew. Alyssa's boyfriend's mom took Alyssa over to her friend's house, and they called the rape crisis hotline. The police were also called, and Alyssa was taken to the hospital. Her boyfriend and his mom later picked Alyssa up from the hospital. And instead of having compassion, empathy, and understanding for what happened to Alyssa, her boyfriend spent the entire ride home yelling at Alyssa, telling her that the rape was her fault because she was a tease and she was quote-unquote asking for it. I understand that that was how society felt about rape at the time, but it doesn't make it any less disgusting. No one is ever asking for it, no matter how they're dressed, how they act, etc. The victim is not the one to blame. The rapist is the one who's at fault. No one was arrested for Alyssa's rape. Instead, the rapist remained under the radar and continued raping and attacking young girls and women. On October 27, 1980, 13-year-old Colleen Kelly came home from school with a friend who was helping her bake a cake for Colleen's mom's birthday. Colleen's friend left around 8:45 p.m. because it was a school night. About an hour later, Colleen's older sister called and Colleen's mom went to go pick her up from work. Colleen's dad was working the graveyard shift at Boeing, so Colleen was home alone. Of course, this isn't unusual for a 13-year-old, especially in the 80s. Colleen took a bath and then relaxed in the living room, watching TV and reading a magazine. Colleen heard some strange noises by the front door, specifically the rattling of a garbage can lid, but Colleen assumed it was just some neighborhood kids. Then Colleen heard a window open. All of a sudden, a man was standing in front of Colleen. The man had a nylon stocking covering his face. Colleen stood up and tried to run, but the man grabbed her and put his hand over her mouth. Quote, "The way he grabbed me, I couldn't kick him. I couldn't grab a hold of anything. He just took me to my room," end quote. Colleen screamed as the man held her down by her hands and knees on the floor. The man punched Colleen in the low back several times, and he threatened to keep punching her if she didn't shut up. The man rolled Colleen onto her back and tore her underwear off. He pulled down his shorts and got on top of her. Colleen tried to reach for a hammer she had in her room, but it was just out of reach. The man told Colleen to spread her legs. Instead, Colleen crossed her legs and kept them crossed until the man punched her in the stomach. Quote, "He hit me, and I think my body just went limp," end quote. Colleen told the man that her mom would be home soon, and the man told her that he'd rape her mom, too. Around 10 p.m., Colleen's mom, Joanne, got home. According to Joanne, she, quote, "put the key in the door and heard someone run and a door slam," end quote. Colleen came out of her room, and her mom knew instantly that something had happened because Colleen was as white as a ghost and she couldn't talk. A few minutes later, Joanne called the police. Joanne's bedroom window was open and the screen had been popped out. Colleen was taken to a rape crisis center for an exam. After the assault, Colleen stayed home from school for 2 weeks. She went from getting good grades to failing her classes, and she gave up gymnastics. Colleen said that she was, quote, "just kind of in like a daze for the longest time," end quote. Colleen wouldn't sleep in her own bedroom. Her parents set up a makeshift bed for her in their room. This next part is so incredibly heartbreaking to me. Colleen slept holding her mom's hand. Joanne said that Colleen wouldn't let her hand go. If Joanne rolled over and let Colleen's hand go, Colleen would scream. Quote, "she did that all night long," end quote. After the assault, Colleen's dad walked around their neighborhood in Southeast Portland, quote, "making sure that guy wasn't around," end quote. Colleen's counselor suggested that the family move, and 2 months later, they did. It helped a little, but it didn't fix everything. Colleen eventually dropped out of Centennial High School. Like Danielle, Colleen never really learned to trust men after her assault. She refused to live in a ground-level home, and she asked her employer to walk her to her car at night. Just like in Danielle's case, Colleen's rapist wouldn't be caught for years. And because the rapist wasn't caught, he would continue raping and assaulting young girls. Not even 2 months after Colleen's assault, the rapist would strike again. 17-year-old Renee Smith had dropped out of school and was renting a home with her boyfriend in Portland. On December 11, 1980, around 5:30 p.m., Renee's boyfriend went to play basketball with his friends at a nearby school. Renee was in the kitchen washing dishes. Around 6 p.m., Renee walked from the kitchen to the master bedroom. As she was walking, she thought she heard a noise coming from the spare bedroom, but she brushed it off. A man appeared out of nowhere and grabbed her. The man put his arms around Renee's waist and covered her mouth. Renee tried to scream, but the man grabbed her even tighter. The man forced Renee into the bedroom. He knocked Renee onto the bed and told her to roll over onto her back. The man covered Renee's face with a blanket and tied her wrists together with a sock. Renee tried to remain calm as the man assaulted her. After he was finished, the man left and Renee was able to free herself from the sock. Renee grabbed her boyfriend's gun from under the bed and then called police at 6:20 p.m. Renee was taken to the hospital where her mom, boyfriend, and a rape victim's advocate all came to be with her. Back at Renee's house, police dusted a light bulb that was apparently unscrewed outside the garage, but they didn't find any prints. A police dog tracked the man's scent to Southeast 147th Avenue, but the trail ended there. Renee didn't tell anyone about the assault outside of her immediate family. She eventually moved because she had trouble sleeping after the assault and she didn't feel safe in the house. Renee's boyfriend felt guilty for not being there to protect Renee, but he always supported Renee. Renee started using cocaine and moved out of the state at 21. She lived with her sister and eventually got clean. But life didn't get any easier for Renee. In Florida, she was drugged and sexually assaulted by 3 men. No one was arrested in that case. In Alabama, Renee was in an abusive relationship. Unsurprisingly, after everything she'd been through, Renee didn't trust men. On January 14, 1981, 25-year-old Patricia Hinkle was cleaning her brother's house on Southeast 156th Avenue. The doorbell rang twice around 8:40 p.m. The first time, no one was there. But the second time was a different story. A man grabbed Patricia by the neck, threw her onto the ground, and dragged her to a pile of wood chips on the side of the house. The man pulled Patricia's sweatshirt over her face and raped her. After he left, Patricia called her parents. After the assault, Patricia struggled to keep a job and started using cocaine. She got involved with the wrong men and, quote, never could get on a straight track, end quote. Sadly, Patricia's mom died suddenly from a heart attack in 1986. Patricia continued in a downward spiral after that. That is, until May 14, 1989. That day, Patricia's older brother got a call from police. Trigger warning here for suicide. Police told Patricia's brother that his sister had committed suicide. She didn't leave a note, but her brother said that she was very unhappy. Quote, she was kind of lost. It's frustrating and painful. We wish we could have done something more or gotten her help. End quote. There would be a gap in rapes and sexual assaults from 1981 to 1986. On December 6, 1986, 13-year-old Tiffany Edens was doing chores in the kitchen of her home when the stereo went dead all of a sudden. A man holding a blanket to his face and chest rushed toward her. The two struggled, but the man threw Tiffany onto the floor. Tiffany's mom, Rebecca, came home from work shortly after the assault and saw police cars outside the home. The family got a guard dog and installed an alarm system after the assault. Tiffany was an honor student and a dancer, but after the assault, she started using drugs and alcohol. Quote, her childhood was taken away in an instant, end quote. She was diagnosed with anxiety and post-traumatic stress disorder. She didn't feel safe after the assault. Tiffany Edens was the last known victim of Richard Gilmore, aka the jogger rapist. Gilmore was convicted in 1987 of raping Tiffany, who again was just 13 years old when she was assaulted. Despite confessing to the other rapes and assaults I told you about, Gilmore could only be charged with and prosecuted for Tiffany's assault because the statute of limitations had expired for the other cases. At the time, Oregon had a 3-year statute of limitation for the crime of rape. Gilmore was also convicted of burglary, and he was sentenced to 30 years, which was the maximum for that crime. Gilmore was sentenced to at least 30 years in prison with a 60-year maximum for the rape. Oregon law at the time had indeterminate sentences, which meant that the parole board would determine the actual length of Gilmore's sentence. The parole board would later cut Gilmore's sentence in half in 1988 because they said that one of the 15-year minimum sentences the judge handed down was, quote, inappropriate and unnecessary, end quote, for protecting the public. Yes, you heard that correctly. It was inappropriate and unnecessary to hand down an additional 15-year minimum sentence to a man who'd admitted to several rapes and assaults and essentially got away with them because the statute of limitations had expired. The judge who sentenced Gilmore had factored the 7 other rapes into the sentence he gave Gilmore. 28-year-old Gilmore had wanted to be a police officer, and before Tiffany's assault, he even applied to the Gresham Police Department. He even made the eligibility list. Thankfully, he was arrested before he could be hired. Gilmore was first up for parole in 2001. The parole board refused to release him. He was denied parole because a psychological evaluation said that Gilmore was a narcissistic individual who posed a threat to the community. Gilmore was again denied parole in 2003 and 2005. And then 2007 rolled around. The parole board decided to release Gilmore despite a psychological evaluation that stated Gilmore, quote, continued to suffer from a severe personality disorder, one not amenable to community-based treatment or supervision, end quote. The psychologist said that Gilmore had an over 75% chance of a repeat sexual offending within 10 years. Despite the psych evaluation and without any explanation, the parole board said, quote, we've decided that we can take a risk with you, end quote, meaning Gilmore. The parole board felt that even though Gilmore was still dangerous, he could be, quote unquote, adequately controlled with supervision and treatment in the community. There was no evidence in the record to explain why the parole board changed its position from 2005 when it decided to release Gilmore. Tiffany Edens wasn't notified of Gilmore's 2007 parole hearing, which meant that she wasn't given the opportunity to speak at that hearing. Both Tiffany and the Multnomah County District Attorney sued the parole board. In January 2008, a Marion County judge blocked Gilmore's release 1 week before he was supposed to get out and ordered the parole board to conduct a new hearing to determine whether Gilmore really could be adequately controlled in the community. The parole board was also ordered to give Gilmore's victims the right to present evidence against his release. The judge said that, quote, the only available expert evidence documents that Gilmore is even more dangerous and less amenable to be safely managed in the community, end quote. The parole board released a written statement in defense of their decision to release Gilmore in 2007. They claimed that they considered Gilmore's, quote, long record of positive prison conduct and responsible work history, the many classes and treatment programs he had successfully completed, as well as his understanding of his past criminal behavior, end quote. None of what they said made sense because they literally had multiple psychiatrists and psychologists telling them that that wasn't true. Another parole hearing took place in June 2008. Tiffany and her family testified that the rape devastated Tiffany. Quote, it knocked her off a track of dancing and good grades, end quote. Tiffany started using drugs and alcohol throughout her life, and she still struggled with panic and fear for her safety. Tiffany told the parole board that Gilmore completely took her youth away. 3 more psychological evaluations were submitted for consideration as well. All 3 doctors described Gilmore as a quote-unquote sexual sadist with a severe personality disorder and a strong likelihood to reoffend. One psychologist said that Gilmore was a quote, ritualistic habitual sexual offender, end quote. Another said that Gilmore was a quote, sadistic rapist who would certainly engage in similar behaviors in the future as he had in the past, end quote. The third psychologist said that Gilmore was a, quote, poor risk to comply with parole guidelines, end quote. It was also noted by one of the psychologists that Gilmore had not worked through the issues related to his, quote, chronic and fixated sexual sadistic behaviors toward women, end quote. 2 unnamed prison guards also testified that they thought Gilmore would kill if he was released from prison. Gilmore's release was denied. I'll also note that in 2008, the statute of limitations for rape was now 6 years, and it was 25 years for crimes involving DNA evidence. In 2012, a psychologist said that Gilmore, quote, no longer fit the psychological criteria for a dangerous offender, end quote, but he had not, quote, grappled with his dark side, end quote. 2 years later, Gilmore was evaluated to be low risk, but he canceled his own parole hearing. In 2016, Gilmore had his final psychological evaluation. A psychiatrist warned about Gilmore's quote-unquote dark side, along with the quote dynamics that led to his serial rape behaviors and the underlying possible sadistic emotional feelings involved in acting out the rape behaviors, end quote. This evaluation also said that Gilmore had a quote mental or emotional disturbance, deficiency, condition, or disorder predisposing him to the commission of any crime to a degree rendering the inmate a danger to the health and safety of others, end quote. In December 2022, Richard Gilmore was released from prison. At the time of his release, Gilmore was classified as a sexual offender at the lowest risk of reoffending, i.e., level 1. Gilmore's classification was based on the static 99R, a quote, objective risk assessment tool designed to predict offenders' risk to commit future sexual violence, end quote. This test was developed in 1999 and is one of the most researched and utilized sex offender risk tools in the country. There are 10 questions used to measure risk for sex offenders, including their age, relationship history, personal history, prior charges or convictions, and characteristics of their victims. The total score determines the offender's risk level. Some factors, like age, are worth negative points, while others add points based on the number of prior charges or convictions. A score of -3 to 3 puts an offender at level 1, which is low risk. A score of 4 to 5 is level 2 or moderate risk. And a score of 6 or more puts an offender at level 3, which is high risk. Gilmore received 1 point because he raped a stranger, 1 point for a non-sexual criminal conviction, and 1 point for the burglary conviction, but he received 0 points on everything else because he had no prior sex offense charges or convictions. Gilmore's score was -3 because he was over 60 years old, which canceled out the 3 points he'd received for the other questions. Gilmore could only receive a score for Tiffany's rape because he wasn't charged or convicted with the other rapes and assaults that he committed. If he could have been charged with those crimes, he would have been well over the high-risk/level 3 score. Here's why the scores are important. They determine who has to be notified about the offender. The public part of the sex offender registry is reserved for level 3 high-risk offenders only. According to the Oregon Parole Board website, the state can only alert a person who lives with the offender when the offender is low-risk/level 1. That means not only do they not have to notify victims, they don't have to notify the community either. When an offender is level 2 or moderate risk, the state has to notify the person the offender is in a relationship with, neighbors and churches in the area, parks, schools, daycares, convenience stores and businesses, other places kids or potential victims may frequent, and long-term/residential care facilities. If an offender is classified as high risk slash level 3, all of the people at level 2 have to be notified, plus the state has to notify local/regional media sources. And any member of the public who views the sex offender registry online is able to see anyone who's a level 3/high risk sex offender. Tiffany called Gilmore's classification a quote, slap in the face, end quote. Other victims of Gilmore said that knowing he was locked up gave them peace of mind, but all that changed after Gilmore was released. Gilmore's, quote, advanced age of 63 proved to be the single biggest factor in the state's classification as a low-level offender, end quote. Tiffany and other victims tried to petition the governor to change Gilmore's classification to ensure better monitoring and tracking in the community, but the governor declined. She claimed that she had no power to change anyone's risk score or increase their notification level. When Gilmore was released in December 2022, he had to register as a lifetime sex offender. According to the parole board, quote, despite his low-risk status, Gilmore was placed on a high-risk supervision plan, end quote. Gilmore will be on active supervision for at least 3 years following his release, and he'll be required to attend regular check-ins with his parole officer. He could return to prison if he violates any of his conditions of parole prior to 2034. His parole conditions include a curfew, an electronic ankle monitor, no contact with anyone under the age of 18 without prior approval from the county supervising office, and he isn't allowed to be in a place where minors under 18 are. Gilmer will also be subject to random polygraph tests and random computer and property searches. Gilmer's risk level is supposed to be reviewed every year. In 2013, a bill was introduced to try and change the testing done for the classification of sex offenders. Instead of the static 99, legislators wanted to use the stable 2007. This test addressed risk factors that could change over time or specific to an individual and also included an interview of the offender. The test covers 13 major areas, including concern for others, hostility towards women, and impulsivity. Unfortunately, the bill didn't pass because it was considered too expensive and time-consuming to administer the test. Richard Gilmer remains in the community at a low risk / level 1, which means that the public doesn't have to be notified that he's living in their community. Recovering from sexual assault or rape can be a lengthy process. Quote, "The emotional reaction to sexual assault is complex and often confusing," end quote. There's no right or wrong way to feel or react. Because April is National Sexual Assault Awareness Month, I want to make sure the definition of sexual assault is clear in case anyone out there isn't sure if it applies to them. Sexual assault occurs, quote, "anytime someone is forced, coerced, and/or manipulated into any unwanted or illegal sexual activity," end quote. Sexual assault is a broad term and has a wide spectrum. As I mentioned when discussing today's cases, sexual violence survivors are more likely to smoke, abuse alcohol, use drugs, and engage in risky sexual activity. According to Rain, 33% of women who are raped contemplate suicide, and 13% of women who are raped actually attempt to commit suicide. It's normal for survivors to feel shame or guilt, and they often have difficulty trusting others or feeling safe. Rape trauma syndrome is a group of reactions, emotional, physical, behavioral, that are reported by victims of attempted or completed rape. According to Rain, there are three stages of rape trauma syndrome: the acute phase, the outward adjustment phase, and the resolution phase. In the acute phase, which occurs immediately following the assault, the victim might act as if nothing happened or that everything is fine. This phase usually lasts a few days to a few weeks. In the outward adjustment phase, the victim starts using coping techniques to try and move on from the assault. These include minimization, dramatization, suppression or refusing to talk about it, and flight, where the victim changes jobs or moves or changes their appearance. Finally, in the resolution phase, the assault is no longer the central focus of the survivor's life. Quote, "when the assault is committed by a stranger, fear seems to be the most difficult emotion to manage for many people," end quote. It's important to remember that each sexual assault is different and that anyone can be the victim of sexual assault. Friends and family of rape / sexual assault survivors should respect the survivor's choices and style of coping. They should also have patience with the survivor's healing process. If you or someone you know has been the victim of a sexual assault, please contact RAIN at 1-800-656-4673. Their hotline is available 24/7, and it's both free and confidential. We'll also include a link to RAIN's website in our show notes for this episode. Thank you for listening to this episode. Please subscribe to the show on whatever podcast app you're currently listening on. If you haven't already, we'd appreciate it if you left a review or rating of our show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. All of our sources for this episode can be found in our show notes. If you're interested in supporting our show, you can join our Patreon for just $5 a month. The link is in our show notes, but you can also go to patreon.com/truecrimecatlawyer. Patreon members receive bonus content, a shout out in an episode, and other goodies throughout the year. Patreon members also get an exclusive promo code and sticker when they shop in our Etsy store. Speaking of our Etsy shop, you can find the link to the shop in our show notes or search for True Crime Cat Lawyer on Etsy. We have all kinds of true crime and cat stickers, plus some true crime beaded pens. All of the proceeds from our Patreon and Etsy shop are donated to animal rescues and shelters. This is an important mission of ours, and we've proudly donated to over 11 organizations so far. And last but not least, if you're interested in learning more about Podcat Winston, you can find her on Instagram at WinstonTheCatPDX. Thanks again for listening, and stay tuned for our next episode. Fire Breathing Kittens is a comedy fiction podcast, an actual play one-shot show that plays various tabletop role-playing games with a season-long plot. Because there's a beginning and an end to each week's story, you can start at any episode. Every week has a different combination of four from the same rotating cast group of people. Join Fire Breathing Kittens as they solve detective mysteries, attempt comedic banter, and enjoy friendship.